This is Let's Talk Tribe, episode 23. Please don't put me in a headlock. Recorded on March 3rd, 2016. Welcome to Let's Talk Tribe, the official Let's Go Tribe podcast with your hosts, me, Matt Lyons, and Jason Lucart. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm feeling good. Baseball has been played. There's something new, semi-concrete to talk about.
It's some kind of baseball anyway. I don't know if I'd call it real baseball quite yet, but it's real enough that they can watch it on TV. So
it's semi-real. It's more real than the baseball they weren't playing last month.
Right, exactly. That kind that was in my head. So other than the baseball, we're going to get right into things. There was the good, which is baseball being played, and the bad, which happened right after, not right after, but the day after we did our podcast last week, was that Abraham Amonte got suspended 80 games for PED use. I'm sure you saw that, and everybody saw that. So what he was, I'm not going to go too much into it, but what he was suspended for was something called boldenone, which is obviously in violation of the drug policy. And it's just your typical anabolic steroid used to bulk up. It can be used to treat osteoporosis, but I'm guessing he doesn't have it. Just shot in the dark there. He did take full responsibility, but he said he does not know how it got into his body, which I would have rather him just said, I was trying to get an edge, so I took a drug. I wish they would all kind of say that, but nobody really seems to.
Yeah, and I don't blame them. I know I understand why people wish they would. And I think people imagine that they would be more accepting if a player just said that. But at least in terms of like great players after the fact, who it's just like if they would just admit it and apologize. Mark McGwire is a perfect example of someone who did eventually just admit it and apologize. And people mostly just use it as an excuse to rake him over the coals again. I feel like people are going to, wherever you stand on this stuff, I feel like ultimately people don't really react that differently. If a guy denies it, there's like, oh, you know, he's lying. And if he does what Amonte does, which is sort of takes responsibility, he's not saying the test is wrong, but he's saying he doesn't know how it got in there. I have no idea what I would say in that situation. Maybe I should try steroids and try to cover it up for a while. And then when I finally get busted, I guess I can see how I handle it.
Just do a few podcasts on steroids for a little bit and see how it goes. And you said how McGwire, because I think, like with him, and I think Pettit did it too, was they denied it at first and then they admitted it later, which just kind of brought it up twice. Like I was thinking, if you know you did it and you're going to have to admit it anyway, I would just do it. I don't know if I would do it, but I'm saying.
Well, and Pettit's such a weird case. I feel like he somehow has completely avoided, not completely, but mostly avoided the, whatever you want to call the reaction that people have to Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens and Mark McGwire and guys like that. Pettit somehow, it just does not get talked about the same way. I don't know if it's his personality or the fact that he was on those great Yankees teams. Although to me, that seems like all the more reason to rip him for him. It's an excuse to try to take the Yankees down a peg. But I feel like Pettit has gotten sort of like a free ride on it. And he did admit it, but he admitted to doing it the one time that he got tested and caught. Sort of that like, oh yeah, I did do it. It's the only time I did it. Whereas McGwire's was a little more like, yeah, it was an ongoing thing. Pettit's a fascinating case to me. I would love to get a better sense of why Pettit hasn't been treated the way Bonds, Clemens, McGwire, those three especially, have been treated.
Well, I think with Clemens, it was just because he was kind of a dick about the whole thing. And he just dragged it out as far as he could. And then with McGwire, Sosa, and Bonds, they were all hitting home runs and got so many people caught up in it. I think it hurt more when it came out they were cheating than like Andy Pettit, who was just a pitcher.
Yeah, I definitely think people react more strongly with the hitters, mm-hmm. and Clemens is sort of an exception because he's been such a dick, such an accomplished pitcher. Again, it just feels to me like among all-star caliber players, Pettit has gotten, you know, the kid glove treatment and has sort of gotten a free pass for it in a way that other guys haven't.
Yeah, and I don't think Abraham Amonte is quite an all-star player. maybe almost. I know you didn't think he was going to be much anyway, but I had a little more high hopes than you did, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I wasn't like terrified of going into the season with him as the opening day, you know, regular center fielder. But I didn't have high enough hopes that I feel like him missing half a season is a huge blow to the team. I think it's more just like it's a drag to have a player on your team go through this and have this be what people's attention is on and wonder, you know, oh, how is it going to be when he comes back? And mostly I'm just so tired of all the drug talk stuff. All these conversations have been had about so many other players. More than being mad at the player for breaking the rules, I'm mad at the player for making me have to listen to people lose their minds about this again.
Yeah, I think that was kind of that feels like it was kind of the census, because after maybe a day, nobody talked about it.
Yeah.
And this is probably the first time since Friday that people have talked about it. It's just us recapping it, which I'm sure when his suspension's about to be up, we might hear about it again, but I think people are just sick of it.
Yeah, and I do think I'm among those who, with the guys like Bonds and McGuire and Clemens, it's not quite that I totally don't care, but I mostly don't care. Like, all three of them would have my Hall of Fame vote if I had a Hall of Fame vote. It doesn't bother me nearly the way it bothers a lot of people. It does bother me more when players get caught for it now, just because Major League Baseball is handling it so differently. I feel like to some extent, baseball was just turning a blind eye to all of it, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And so mostly I don't care that they were doing it. Whereas now, you know, they've gotten much more hardline about it and they have, you know, this system. So I do think it's worse for players to be using it now than 10, 15 years ago, just because there's no question about the fact that they're not supposed to be doing it now. And they know they're much more likely to get caught now than they were then. I certainly wish Almonte weren't suspended for 80 games.
Yeah, definitely.
But, oh well.
Well, it's not a huge blow, but the blow that it is now what are we going to do in center field? Or what the Indians going to do in center field? And they don't have, I wouldn't call them solid options. It's just going to be kind of a mishmash, which it already was going to be, because I don't think Almonte would have been an everyday center fielder anyway. So the biggest way it'll impact the Indians, obviously, is what are they going to do now in center field? And of the players they have in camp, they have Tyler Naquin, Colin Cowgill, Rajai Davis, Shane Robinson, and Will Venable, none of which are going to be all that great on their own. But I don't think the way the Indians were setting up their outfield, they don't plan on anybody being great on their own. It seems like it's all about platoon partners right now.
Right.
And for me, my choice is going to be to hope that it's going to be Naquin and Davis in center field.
Yeah, I would go the same way. I feel like, you know, Davis is going to be on the roster either way and, you know, probably playing a little left field until Brantley's back too, depending on who the other options are or who's in the lineup that day. So of the other guys you mentioned who aren't all going to be on the roster, I think Naquin ought to at least be the leader for it too. He hasn't had the opportunity yet. I've said this before that there's something appealing just about a lot of these guys have a track record that tells you they're probably not going to get it done. And Naquin just doesn't have a track record yet. Everyone seems to agree he's a good defender, so at least you feel like you're going to get good defense out of him. And he's not someone, you know, with Lindor, when you're like, oh, when are you going to call him up in terms of service time? Naquin seems like a solid player potentially. He doesn't seem like a potential star. He's not the kind of player I think teams need to worry about service time so much. And they can always send him down for 2 weeks later to get the extra year if they're worried about it anyway. So unless he has a really bad next month, I'm with you. I'd love to see Naquin there.
Yeah, and the weird thing is maybe even just a month ago, with or without Almonte, I wasn't even looking at Naquin as a real option. He was just kind of there in camp. But now suddenly, even though he hasn't really done anything, he just seems more appealing for some reason. I guess as it's getting closer, we're going to have to make a decision. It just looks like I'd want him and Davis looking at their splits.
Right.
Because I know Naquin's not great against, what is it, lefties? Yeah, and Davis has a really big split. 118 WRC plus against lefties in his career. So I think that'd make a good combination. And then left field, who knows when Brantley's going to be back, which looks sooner and sooner. So that center field combination could work early on.
Yeah, I think part of it in terms of like talking about a month ago, I think when you assumed Almonte's going to be on the roster, I don't really want Naquin on the roster if he's only going to start once or twice a week. You know, so when I expected Almonte to be starting 4 or 5 days a week out there, I'd rather have Naquin playing every day in Columbus than, you know, playing a game and a half a week. But now that there's the opening for whoever becomes the primary center fielder, even if they're not playing every day, to at least be starting 4 or 5 games a week, if he can get that kind of playing time, I'm much more interested in seeing what Naquin can do.
Yeah, if he can just stay healthy and because he's got the speed and defense, we already know, which is going to be pretty similar to Davis, I think. So.
Yeah, and you know, you've got to be able to hit a bit. We saw this with Urshela at third base last year. The defense is great, but at some point, I mean, if you can't get on base at all, really, the glove isn't enough to outweigh that. But, you know, see what he's got. I don't feel like any of the other options are such a good bet to do well. I'd rather at this point go with the guy who feels like there's, you know, maybe a little higher ceiling for what he can do.
Yeah, going to start the season with Will Venable and Colin Cowgill in center field isn't exactly awe-inspiring there.
Mama Cowgill's not going to like the sounds of that.
Sorry, Colin. I know you're a listener and you love the podcast. I know. Just like the Indians listen. So with the outfield, if you heard this week that Brantley is apparently ahead of schedule, he went from no contact, just picking up a bat and swinging it, to hitting off a tee, and now he's doing soft toss. And Terry Francona had some nice words to say about it, that he was getting back. He's on a quick recovery, quicker than they thought. Everyone's saying that it sounds like now, just because of the couple quotes, he could be back opening day, but they don't want to say it. I don't really see it like that. It just seems like a non-story to me. It's the same thing they've been saying all off-season long, that Brantley thinks he's going to be back soon. He's working hard. It doesn't seem like much of a story. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. I think, to some level, they get, you know, Francona gets asked questions and he's got to say something.
Yeah.
I'd rather he's saying over and over and over again that Brantley looks good, you know, progress is a little faster than they expected. I'd rather hear him saying that than the opposite. Because I do think if the recovery weren't going very well, you'd want to temper people's expectations by saying, you know, we've said all along, you might miss a month and, you know, we still feel like there's a good chance that's a reasonable timetable. So I do think it makes sense to start to think he's going to be back sooner than we thought. To me, the idea of opening day still seems like no way. And scares me that they'd be rushing, in which I don't want. The schedule is so light on games early on. If he misses 2-3 weeks even, he's still only going to miss like 14-15 games in those 3 weeks. And I'd rather have him at 100% than rush him. But yeah. We'll see. Maybe he is that far ahead of schedule. Maybe that, you know, walking around picking up bats and swinging that stuff, maybe that really helped.
It's really did something. They even talked about maybe getting him some spring training bats, I saw, or at-bats.
Yeah,
I mean, he's got a – Francona's got to kind of toe a line there, because if he gets – if they know Brantley's not going to be back for a couple weeks and they start hyping it up more and more that it might be back close to the beginning of the season, and then suddenly Brantley's not there after a week – that's going to start people thinking, oh, no, he's worse than expected, because that one time in spring training, Terry Francona said he's doing great. So it's just kind of a little tight walk he's working there. But either way, yeah. I think he's going to come back fine whenever he comes back, I hope. It's a lot better than...
And missing 10% of the season's games, you know, ultimately, is not that big a deal. It's a long season.
It kind of makes it a little more of a bummer that he didn't do the surgery a little earlier. I mean, we don't know all the details, obviously, but if they would have just... instead of doing the rehab program or right in the surgery, you'd think he'd easily be back by opening day, I would think. But that's right. Just hindsight, I guess.
Ah, hindsight.
It's the best. So, I know you said before we started you didn't get to watch any of the spring training games, but...
I've examined the box scores closely, though.
Have you? Have you looked at those important spring training numbers, and they mean everything, and we should react very heavily to them?
I'm ready to say that we should probably just cancel the season. The Indians clearly don't have it this year.
Danny Salazar, he was bad for an inning, so I mean, just cut him. I mean,
yes, cut him in a mean way, not like a polite. You tried your best. Just
tweet at him that he's cut.
Yeah, like a Homer Simpson. Just you're cut. Get out of here.
But yeah, I watched a little bit of it. The first one, Carlos Santana homeward, which was nice.
Yes.
Eric Stamets, which I didn't know, but apparently he grew up in Columbus. He's an Indians fan, so that's neat.
Didn't know that either.
Yeah, and then James Ramsey looked bad, 0-for-2 with 2 strikeouts. But I mean, again, in spring training, we're just talking numbers that don't matter at all. And I mean, I've heard like people say, well, I've looked at spring training and I noticed this guy was going to be bad and I called it and then he was bad. But you could just spin a dial and land on anybody and say, I saw this guy had a bad spring training and he was bad. Or it's just confirmation bias, I guess, because...
Yes.
Yeah, you can look at anybody.
People remember their successes right. and mention those. I went to the casino and won $50, and they don't mention the four other times I went to the casino and lost $100 every time.
Good thing in that first game was Naquin. That did you see a highlight of it all with the triple that he hit?
Yep.
That was so nice. Look at watching him run the bases. I mean, if you look at his head with the camera moving, it's just straight flat. It was such a smooth run.
Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't translate like anything, but
it'd be more fun to see them win 9-1 than lose 9-1. But especially this first week, like,
who cares?
Yeah, don't get hurt. Stay healthy. You know, at some point, they've shown that strikeout and walk rate are the two things that do have some correlation to the regular season. Mm-hmm. You know, so I don't want Danny Salazar walking, you know, two guys in an inning all spring, but his first outing, whatever.
Yeah, he looked pretty bad right away, but then he struck out 5 in a row.
Yeah.
So now he's going to be the Cy Young, obviously. I mean, that's how it works. Exactly. He came out apparently pretty amped up, is what Tito said. Which, I mean, that's what spring training's for.
I love spring training because he's supposed to use like 7 pitchers in a game, which I think is one of his favorite things.
Yeah.
He's got to love, like, oh man, I've got so many guys in the bullpen, they won't even all fit on the bench. So I bet Francona loves this first week of spring when no one's going more than 2 innings.
Oh yeah, he's in heaven. And he gets to bat as catcher's second for no reason, just to get him more at bats. Oh, that's pretty smart. I don't know if you heard why he does that, but he does it just to get him more at bats without keeping him in very long.
Right.
So I guess that's good.
Knows his stuff. As much as we like to complain it, he mostly knows what he's doing.
I like Tito. I don't complain about him. I don't think ever. I think he's a good manager. Second game, Jeff Manship blew a perfect game. So, I mean, just cut him.
The spring training perfect game is what we've been waiting for since 1981.
It was a collective perfect game, which actually Cody Anderson, the first 2 innings, I think, had a perfect game. And then Manship blew it in the fourth. It doesn't matter, though.
I said this, talking about no hitters and perfect games, I think Bauer pitched most of it last year. But there was a game, maybe a couple games, that the Indians took a no-hitter pretty late. But it wasn't just one pitcher. I think like Bauer threw 6 no-hit innings and then a couple other guys came in and then it got blown in the 9th and fans were really bummed because the Indians had a no-hitter. And I came out and said, no, I'm glad it got blown. When the Indians have a no-hitter, I really don't like the group no-hitter. I don't know why. It just doesn't feel like an actual no-hitter to me. I know that makes like a, you know, old Hoss Radburn in my day, we finished what we started. But it only feels like a half no-hitter. So if and when the Indians get one, I want one guy pitching all 9 innings.
Of course. And not to happen in spring training. You were talking about regular season, though, right?
Yes.
I vaguely remember that he was...
Spring training, I don't care. Guys
I wonder, has it happened in spring training, though? Now I'm curious. I'll have to look that up later. I wonder if anybody's had a perfect game in spring training. It obviously wouldn't be one pitcher. It'd be.
I wonder, I mean, individually, what's the longest outing a pitcher... at least in the last like 20 years has had, we can't look this up. This is a question we're not going to answer, but like no one pitches a whole game in spring training. I don't think, do they?
Oh, that'd be insane. Who would do that? I hope not. Maybe like 30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like there was a time when like Bert Blyleven was out there throwing like 40 innings a week in spring training, but I think those days are behind us.
I hope so. And then, so yesterday, Ramirez homered, Anthony Record homered. Ramirez looks good. I'm excited for him to get more playing time this year, I think, because he's going to be behind Juan Uribe at third base, regardless of what he does at spring. I mean, that's just what he is. He's going to be everywhere, all over the infield. Might even get a little bit of outfield, which would be fun to watch.
Yeah, Terry Francona sure likes everyone to play everywhere. Loves the versatility.
The ghost of Mike Avilas playing center field. I think that's good with – I think it was horrible for Mike Avilas, but I think it's good for Jose Ramirez. He's got the athleticism, I think, to at least – handle left field while Brantley's out.
Yeah, I think for a backup to be able to back up a bunch of positions is great. I generally, with rare exceptions, feel like starters should just have their position. But your bench players, if they can play all over the place, fantastic.
Yeah. So, yeah, then like I said, today's game, Salazar came out, looked rough right away, struck out 5 in a row. And then Shaw looked terrible, which I'm kind of shaky on him this year anyway, regardless of what he did today. But he looked really bad. I don't think he made it out of an inning.
He's thrown, I think, approximately 4 billion in 37 games in the last years. There's certainly the potential that the wheels are going to fall off as well. I mean, to some extent, they did last year, mm-hmm. depending on which pitching metrics you favor. Yeah, I don't think any of us should be surprised if Shaw turns out not to be particularly effective this season, given his workload. Relievers come and go. I mean, obviously we want everyone in the bullpen pitching well, but he's someone I wouldn't be surprised if we've seen his last good year already.
Yeah, and regardless, I like bullpen. I think I'm almost a minority in that, but I like the way they've set it up, I think there's so many arms going for it. At least a couple of them are going to be able to replace Shaw, especially Armstrong, who pitched today, but I didn't watch him. Because with having kids all day, it's hard to watch a full game. But I didn't get to see him pitch, but he threw today too. I don't know how he did. I'm sure he did fine. Well, whatever, it was 9-1, so maybe he didn't do fine.
9 innings of baseball with the kids around, you should save it for the regular season.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, 3 games of spring training. We've got to watch a little bit of real baseball. Now we won't get to watch until Saturday. Which, I mean, by then, nobody's going to – or not Saturday. It's maybe it is Saturday. It's a few days. We don't get to watch. By then, nobody's going to care about spring training anymore anyway. And we're just going to be looking forward to the regular season.
Yeah, it's checking the box. It really is no one get hurt.
Exactly.
If you told me, like, if someone offered me between now and opening day, no one on the Indians will suffer any sort of injury, I would not care what their statistics are. Like,
right. So – the last thing I think we have for today is we've got a few more questions. Unless you had anything else about spring training you want to talk about.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think, we talked about it last week and today. Like, it's fun to have baseball back. It does pretty quickly feel like silly baseball. Or, you know, I mean, the Indians pitchers, like, it'll be, you know, the first time Kluber or Carrasco is expected to actually, you know, go through the lineup twice or something like that. I mean, there are benchmarks that are still kind of interesting to keep an eye on. You know, we talked last week about the fifth starter is, you know, sort of a toss-up situation right now. So when those guys go, you know, it's not that there's nothing to keep an eye out for, but that initial baseball is back wears off pretty quickly when it's just spring training baseball.
Oh, yeah. Like I said last week, they know it when they schedule the broadcast. We got 3 games in a row, and then we skip a day, we have another, and then we have just nothing for weeks because nobody would watch. I mean, even today, I don't think a ton of people were – because, I mean, yesterday on Twitter, or the last 2 days even on Twitter, everybody was talking about the game, and then today it just started to drift away, talking about the Cavs and other things and not about Eric Stametz batting in the fifth inning.
In terms of non-Indian spring training stories, I don't know if you've seen all of this, the fuss. Hank,
yes,
who is the Brewers' unofficial mascot, who's like a stray dog who I think wandered into their camp, was it last year or 2 years ago? And they kind of adopted him, and it was like, you know, one of those cool things that happens for teams. But now there's a lot of thinking, and I think Brew Crew Ball, our SB Nation cousins who cover the Brewers, I think they were the ones who actually got the scoop on this, that supposedly that the Brewers have replaced Hank possibly with a more photogenic dog, or maybe Hank is dead, and the Brewers have called a press conference presumably to deny this conspiracy. This is what spring training's for. So I hope there's a lot more on Hank the dog, and I hope other teams' mascots have possibly been replaced as well. Are we looking at the real slider, or is the slider we're seeing just a replacement?
I think there's a little bit more green in there than there was before for slider.
I think you're right. Look at this.
But with Hank, you say slider. They're calling the conference to disprove it, but they called him Hank 1. With their press conference. They said they're calling a press conference about Hank 1 was their exact words. I am all on board with this conspiracy. That either, like you said, he's dead. They just replaced him because he had a little marks around his eyes or whatever. But there's a new Hank in the Brewers.
And if you're a Brewers fan, like, if you're not aware, the Brewers are on full-on rebuild right now.
So this is all you have to root for, I mean.
So I think a dog conspiracy is a great thing for Brewers fans right now.
It's the best thing they have looked forward to all season.
Exactly.
What is that press conference anyway? I thought it was today.
I don't know. Tomorrow? I think they scheduled to last 6 or 7 hours, expecting there will be a lot of questions to get through. But I'm not sure on the start time.
DNA test results and whole courtroom thing. Make a Netflix series out of it.
Yes. See? It's Wisconsin, making of a murder territory. I'm just saying. I'm not saying.
What do they call that?
Was involved, but I'm not saying he wasn't.
It's a new Hank. I'm not even. There's no reportedly. Even if they deny it, they need to get to the bottom of that. It's clearly a new dog. More important things is our listener questions. We got the first one from @ntully on Twitter. This question is all for you. Who are the Cleveland's top three free agent signings in the past 20 years?
All right. Top free agent signings of the last 20 years. Let's see. Well, at number, I like actually ranking things. I've got three in mind. I'm trying to now actually rank them in my mind. I'm going to say number three was the minor league deal that they signed Casey Blake to. So this was in 2003. Casey Blake signed a minor league deal with the Indians and immediately became an above average player and continued to be an above average player for most of his time with the Indians. A lot of time at third base, played some outfield too. But he was, you know, never a great player, but was a really solid player who the Indians initially got team control over without even any guaranteed money. And then the best thing about Casey Blake's time with the Indians, or maybe not the best thing, but one of the great things, is that the end of his time with the Indians, they were somehow able to dupe the Dodgers into trading a catching prospect named Carlos Santana for what was left of Casey Blake's contract. And so that minor league deal that they signed Casey Blake to not only gave them Casey Blake, but led to them getting Carlos Santana, who, regardless of what Indians fans would have you believe, has been a really good player for the Indians.
So before you get to the next one, how would you compare that to turning Joey Wendell into Rob Kaminsky? I guess we don't know yet, but...
We don't know yet. See, yeah, I feel like if Kaminsky turns out to do as much for the Indians as Carlos Santana has, I'd be really happy with that. So I think sort of your high-end outcome for that Joey Wendell for Brandon Moss, turning Brandon Moss into Kaminsky, the high end of that would be that it works out as well as signing Casey Blake to a minor league deal. So that would be my number three, would be the minor league deal for Casey Blake. And I know a lot of listeners are like, really, the third best free agent in the last 20 years that the team has signed was Casey Blake. But you got to think about what these guys cost. So for next to nothing, they got that. So that would be my number three. Okay. My top two are higher profile. Number two would be Kenny Lofton, who a lot of Indians fans might forget that the Indians signed as a free agent. They also traded for Kenny Lofton in one of the best trades the team has made. Such a good trade that at the moment, I don't even remember the name of who they gave up to get Kenny Lofton. But then he left. You know, they traded him away basically for David Justice, and they got Marquise Grissom because he was going to be a free agent. So 1997, the second year of the glory year, or the second World Series appearance, a lot of people forget that Kenny Lofton wasn't on that team. But that offseason, there was a reunion. They signed him back to a three-year deal with a club option. And he wasn't quite as good as he was in his first stint with the team, but was still really, really good. Great defense in center field, a lot of stolen bases, made a couple more all-star teams. So bringing him back as a free agent, it was a three-year, $24 million contract. So $8 million a year for Kenny Lofton back then. So that worked out really well. But number one, and I don't think there's any question about this, best free agent signing the Indians have made, and one of the best free agent signings any team has made in the last 20 years.
Nick Swisher.
you ruined it. Yes, Nick Swisher because of his clubhouse presence.
Exactly.
No, Roberto Alomar was a phenomenal signing. They signed him for 4 years, $30 million, so not even $8 million a year. And he was already maybe the best second baseman in baseball when they signed him. And then he was even better with the Indians. 1999 to 2001, his 3 years with the Indians, he was fantastic. Just those 3 years were enough to make him, you know, one of the two or three best second basemen in franchise history. He was fantastic. He was top five in the MVP voting a couple of times. Was a Gold Glove winner and All-Star all 3 years. And he hit .323 with a .405 on base percentage and a .515 slugging percentage. And then to top everything off, the Indians actually traded him before the fourth year of that deal, and he completely fell apart. They ended up not getting anything that really panned out. But so they had him for 3 years for about $22 million, and he would have been worth, you know, more than twice that much. So I think Roberto Alomar, definitely the best free agent signing in Indians history.
Yeah, I mean, I was 12 when they traded him away. Or what was that, 2002, right? They traded him away?
Yes.
So I was 12 and outside of Cleveland, so I didn't know the reaction then. But looking at it now, people were angry at that trade for some reason, weren't they? That they got rid of Roberto Alomar? And then he fell apart. It was like the perfect time.
The team apart. You know, 2001 was the last time the Indians made the postseason in that stretch. And so I think, you know, trading Alomar was sort of a sign that things are coming to a close. So I can completely understand why people were annoyed with it.
Maybe if they were at the time, but if you're looking back now, I think you should probably understand that it was kind of a perfect trade.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was, you know, even though the trade didn't, in terms of the prospects the Indians got back, didn't work out. You know, trading a player with 1 year left in his deal for a package of what was supposed to be good prospects certainly made sense. And then the fact that against all odds, Alomar was suddenly finished as not even as an elite player. He was like, he was never even an average player again. I don't know what was going on, but he was finished. But for those 3 years he was with the Indians, he was awesome. And watching him and Omar Vizquel, you know, make plays and turn double plays was a blast.
Yeah. So, yeah, thank you, Ntali, Nick Tully on Twitter. That was a great question. So the next ones we got a whole bunch from Nicholas Kolenik on Facebook, and I figure we'll answer a couple of them. The first one is very important. We need to know. There's going to be Happy Dog at the Progressive Field now, and there's pictures of a hot dog with breakfast cereal on it. Fruit Loops, I think it was. Any thoughts on that? And
I guess I'm intrigued. I can't say it ever occurred to me to put Fruit Loops or any other cereal on a hot dog. So I guess I'm intrigued. But I suppose I would probably rather eat Fruit Loops before I went to the ballpark and then just get like kind of a normal hot dog. But I'm just a square. So Fruit Loops and a hot dog, I say go for it.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty open eating weird, almost gross things. I don't know if you remember the KFC Double Down. I mean, that was just horrible and I loved it. But Fruit Loops on a hot dog, that sort of sounds like something for kids, I guess. Because my kids, they'll put, if you give them options for anything, it'll be all sugar. I guess because I'm already getting old, I'd like more savory things, I guess. But no, I don't want that. I like a bunch of weird hot dog combinations.
If you had to put a cereal on a hot dog, but it didn't have to be Fruit Loops, what cereal would you put?
Hold on. I'm mentally testing like everything in my mouth right now. I should clarify every cereal in my mouth. Jeez. I don't know. I guess Cheerios, just because it'd be bland and I could just ignore it and get to the hot dog. Nothing sounds good off the top of my head. What about you?
I'm thinking maybe like Honey Nut Cheerios. So it's not an overpowering flavor, but just like kind of a touch. You can kind of imagine you've just like brushed the hot dog with honey, and I have no idea if that's a good idea or not. But yeah, I think a more mild cereal makes more sense, because if it's like an overpowering cereal, what are you bothering with the hot dog for?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, if you do like Captain Crunch, what if it gets soggy in between the bun? Or when you bite it, you're going to get cut in the top of your mouth and then get the hot dog juices all up in there? That's horrible.
Cut the roof of your mouth. So I hope you're going to enjoy sitting at the ballpark for the rest of the day blinking with a raw roof of your mouth.
Yeah. Wow, that question. I can't think of anything good. I mean, like, I like a lot of weird things on hot dogs. I'll try just about anything. But I don't know if I'll try cereal. So the next one from him, from Nicholas, was, who was playing first base on Wednesday? It looked like Joey Butler. They were wearing number 94, I think, with no name on the back, and they looked horrible. So I looked into it. The two that played first base were Mike Napoli, and I'm thinking that Nicholas was thinking of Nelly Rodriguez. He was a number 94, and apparently he looked horrible. I didn't see him play because, like I said, I don't get to watch all the games in spring training. But if you were watching and you noticed that pretty much anybody looks horrible in the first two games of spring training, it's probably not a big deal, especially on defense and pitching, because it's just people working together, trying to get things worked out. And it's not, they're not going to have everything down by now. So I'm sure everybody looks horrible on defense right now.
Not Francisco Lindor.
Of course not him.
You could wake him up at 3 a.m. in the dead of winter, and he's going to look beautiful.
You don't have to wake him up. Just throw a ball near him while he's dead asleep. He'll wake up and reach out an arm real quick. But yeah, it was Nelly Rodriguez, I'm almost positive. I don't
Well, I'm
think
glad you
Joe.
were able to solve that mystery because.
I felt good. And then you ruined it by asking me that cereal question that I can't answer. Had that good feeling going. But yeah, I'm sure he looked horrible. I'm sure everybody looks kind of horrible. It doesn't really matter.
And he's not going to be on the roster when opening day rolls
around. Oh, yeah. But so. if nobody knows about Nelly Rodriguez, I mean, that guy has huge forearms. So I don't want to say he was horrible. Now that I think about it, I'm sorry, Nelly. I'm sure. You looked great at first base. Please don't put me in a headlock. But him in general, I'm excited.
Going around offending potential Cleveland Indians tonight.
I know, really. We're doing great. And Roger Clemens. Everybody's going to be after us. But I'm excited about Nelly Rodriguez.
Yeah, he's up here. Big numbers.
Yeah.
Probably not going to win any gold gloves, but he could have some pop.
That was Jason saying that, by the way, Nelly. I think you're going to win all kinds of gold gloves. So hit Jason. Okay. So thank you for that question. And then the next question from Nicholas, the final one, was that he looked on a list of guys on the Indians' 25-man roster, focusing on the 2015 WARs, wins above replacements. He noticed that a lot of guys are all hovering around 1.0. Isn't that below average? Statistically, do most World Series teams have seven or more guys at below one WAR?
Well, there's a lot to unpack here. One, some of the guys he listed as at or below one WAR were a little above it.
Right, that was Gomes, Napoli, Uribe, Davis, Santana, Ramirez, Cowgill, Butler, and Perez.
Which isn't to say they were way better than a one WAR player, but just in terms of comparing to other teams, I'm just going to point out that some of the guys he mentioned were at like 1.4 and things like that. Mm-hmm. Short answer, no. World Series teams don't have seven or more, you know, position players who are at one WAR or fewer. But one, I don't think we're expecting, we're certainly not hoping that every player in the Indians roster is going to put up the same numbers they did last year. So some of the guys like Santana, who was at roughly one win above replacement last year, which is below average, you know, we're expecting and are projected to be better. The other thing is some of the guys he mentioned weren't full-time players. You know, Jose Ramirez was on the list of guys he mentioned. Jose Ramirez at Baseball Reference is at 1.4 WAR and in 355 plate appearances, which is a little more than half a season. So you can't quite double it, but you know, if you put that over 162 games or 600 plate appearances, and now he's at 2.5 WAR. Mm-hmm. So you have to consider the playing time of these players you're mentioning. You know, Roberto Perez, he's the backup catcher. The fact that he was at 1.4 WAR in 70 games, that's like saying he's like a 3.5 win player. So you've got to look at the playing time. But he mentioned, you know, World Series teams. So last year's World Series teams, the Royals and the Mets. The Mets are probably the better comparison point for the Indians because, like the Indians, the Mets have a lot of really good pitching, and so their strength is likely to be their rotation. And if you want to look at 2015 WAR numbers, and again, you want to round to the nearest WAR, so 1.4 only counts as one, the Mets only had five position players on the roster with more than that, with more WAR than that. So you figure you've got like 12, I guess, on an NL team, probably pitchers. So you're looking at 13 position players, and they only had five who were above one, and 13 minus five is eight. So in fact, last year there was a World Series team with more than seven players worth roughly one WAR or less. And this isn't to pick on his question. It's just to point out that the numbers you look at for the Indians last year aren't really, I mean, the team was 81-80. I'm not trying to argue they were a great team. But you don't need to look at the roster and think, oh, my God, there's no way this team can contend. I think people look at projections for their team's players, and they feel like, oh gosh, I looked at the Bakota projections and they've only got Lindor doing this and they've only got Kipnis doing that. But then you look at the Bakota standings, they have the Indians running away with the Central. So I think it's really dangerous to just look at your team's stats in a vacuum because the whole picture when you step back is oftentimes very different.
Yeah, I think it's just a common misunderstanding about WAR too. I think people look at wins above replacement and think that it means if this player has this many wins, the team automatically gets that many. And if it's a bunch of ones, a bunch of players with one win, then it means they're going to get, like, what, 20 wins? But I think it's just a little misunderstanding. And
he's right. One is below average. Right. The idea is that two is roughly average. But that's if you're talking about an everyday player. So if you're looking at Roberto Perez and saying, gosh, you know, he's only at 1.4 WAR, that's actually awesome for a backup catcher. That makes him one of the best backup catchers in baseball. And, you know, same thing with Jose Ramirez. And there are players like Santana who was an everyday player. And, yeah, like one WAR for him is a bad season. You can't have, you know, more than two or three everyday players who are putting up numbers like that. But the Indians don't have like three or four projected starters who look like they're going to be one WAR players. And even someone like Santana, he's not reasonably expected to put up those kind of numbers again. I know a lot of people think he's going to, but I certainly think he's going to be a better player like he has every other season of his career until last year.
Yeah, that goes for a lot of players on the Indians, I think. A lot of people just slumped at once and it kind of dragged all the Jason Kipnis's and Michael Brantley's and pitching staffs down. Was everyone else slumping at the exact same time, it seemed like. Yeah, and I don't think that'll happen again.
No, I mean, someone will slump, but it probably won't be as many players. And again, like the Indians, once they had Lindor on the roster and rid of Swisher and Bourne, they were basically as good as the Royals for like the second half of the season. And that doesn't change the fact that the Royals won the division and the Royals won the World Series and the Indians didn't. But in terms of moving beyond 2015 and looking ahead, you know, there are reasonable reasons to think the Indians can win the Central this year.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't seem like there's much optimism for some reason among fans, I guess because just we're in Cleveland. But I think you're right. They have a chance to compete. So, yeah, that was all our questions. Thank you again to Nick Tully on Twitter and Nicholas Kolonek on Facebook. So, did you have anything else?
No, I feel like, you know, we're into like that weird holding pattern where there will be more games and more stuff to talk about. But as we said tonight, none of it's super significant. Mm-hmm. We've talked about, I think next week we'll have our first guest together. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be, you know, nice to hear what we've got some things lined up to talk to other people about some stuff who have more expertise in particular areas. So it'll be fun to get some other voices in on this.
It's probably not Nelly Rodriguez.
And we're going to try to get some Hank the Dog experts and kind of break that down. That'll be like a 4-episode. Most of March is really just going to be Hank coverage.
I mean, what else is there to cover?
We'll turn off a few listeners, but I think you're going to find yourselves intrigued.
We're going to corner that dog
market. Right now, it's just, as the season gets closer and closer, the excitement of that will build up, even as kind of the fatigue with spring training builds up too. It's a good time of year. Baseball is getting close.
Yeah. We're going to have a lot of box scores to talk about next podcast, I think.
So many box
scores. A whole lot of numbers that don't mean anything. But it'll be fun. It's baseball. It's real baseball. No more just free agents in the past and everything. I'm excited. Okay. So that's another episode. Here goes the music.